So, welcome. This is the last talk in the third noble on the third noble truth. The third noble truth being the truth that there is freedom. And this talk is called "The What Behind the Who." I had fun with that title. Someone remarked that it sounds like a Dr. Seuss. I thought it sounded more like Abbott and Costello routine. Who's on first and what? Anyway, the what behind the who. The first two noble truths have to do, and I just try to use different words to show you a different aspects of it. So that you don't, sometimes when you hear the same repetitive way of the Dharma, you get fixed in a particular meaning for that phrase and you miss sort of the globalization of that wording. And I personally have found it very helpful in my own practice to hear more than one perspective of the pain and how the pain arises. And just to bring us to the third noble truth, that sense of our minds completely blanking the world with its own meaning, with its own sense of purpose and its own projected response. The world means what it means because the mind is translating it that way. And so all of our reactivity, including the differentiation and separation we feel, is because the mind projects that onto the world. So it's a little bit like walking in a house of mirrors, because everything we see is really much more a reflection of what's going on in us than anything at all meaningful in the world. And we keep bumping into those mirrors. And as a story I like to tell around that was, when I was young, I was went to a carnival with my two older brothers, and we went into a house of glass, one of those kind of sort of a labyrinth of a maze of just glass. And I was young, very young. I don't remember, but maybe 6 or 7. And my older brothers are 2 and 4 years older. So they were able to navigate that maze very quickly and get out. But I wasn't. And I kept smashing up against the glass and hurting my head. I was just a little kid. And so I eventually just sat down and started crying because I thought it was hopeless. Well, that's the first and second noble truth. However, the man who ran the place came and found me and showed me the way out, which is the third noble truth. There is a way out. It isn't all bumps, although sometimes we feel like it, don't we? When we keep blaming it on the reflection that we see, we keep blaming it on the glass. And it's really, and so much of it is coming back to an orientation that this is self-induced. That this is a world of problems of self, that were created by me, by my mental frame of reference. We don't understand that. And so this third noble truth is a way that we can live completely free from those projections, and yet at the same time be completely functional within them, so that we don't pretend something is something that it's not. Remembering our name and our history all along the way. So it doesn't call for a wiping away of the slate of memory. It just calls for knowing when memory is activated and having a broader context and vision that something is not just what the mind says it is, which when we only believe what the mind says, we keep walking into the side of those walls. So that's the third noble truth, and we have looked at the third noble truth from a variety of different perspectives, all from the perspectives of the liberation from self-belief, because it is the liberation of self-belief that is the liberating component of this teaching. It's nothing, there's nothing wrong with you. You don't have anything to fix. You need not journey to the Himalayas. You need not do 1,000 penances. And it will not and does not need to take 1,000 lifetimes. We just need to have the proper orientation to the problem and a sincere commitment to put an end to that problem. If you have those two things, which I will talk about from now to the rest of the year in the Eightfold Path, because the Eightfold Path is very much depends upon those two things. A clear direction, an understanding of the problem, and a sincere intent to move beyond that. Because it hurts. You get tired of the bumps on the head. That's the reason sincerity arises. So if you haven't had enough bumps, well, they're out there waiting. We'll be patient. Now, the what behind the who is a different way of looking at the language of liberation. For some of you know that after a talk, we have a discussion, which will be not next week because we have a guest speaker next week, but the week after next. And sometimes during those discussion groups, we do dyads. And sometimes during those dyads, a question is asked, something like, what would you be without this thought? Or what would you be without this particular conclusion? Sometimes it's phrased, who would you be without that? And I have discovered that a very different response comes from all of us when we ask what as opposed to who. And I began to notice that carrying a who with us into meditation has its own fallout, its own limitation. What we may not realize is that there's also a limitation on the what we carry into the meditation. And we're going to look at both of those tonight to get a sense. And I'm going to walk us through, as I want to do, to make this a part of the practice that all of you are doing. And that if you're meditating, and again, this is not a class for walk-ins that have had no previous meditation experience. It's for people who have had the beginning in meditation instructions, because these talks depend, the understanding of these talks depend upon your own willingness and ability to understand yourself through the meditation practice. But sometimes they feel so far out, so distant in terms of where we think of ourselves on the meditation, that we think that these talks are unreachable. And I want to show, and I hope I have already shown, that just the opposite is true. That every one of us is getting a sense of this thing, no matter how long we have sat, that it may not become crystal clear yet to you, but it's beginning to rub, it's beginning to be seen, it's beginning to be noticed. And you may not have come to a crescendo of aha, in which the dawning of a new way of being has yet emerged, but that is part of the willingness to continue to look. That will come. Not always does awakening happen dramatically. In fact, perhaps most oftenly, it happens gradually, over time, over the willingness to persist and be consistent in the meditation. There's just a knowing that comes. You may not have even known when that arose, but there's a knowing that comes with sincerity. And begin to understand what Christ meant when he said, knock and the door shall open. It's not far-reaching. Don't put it out of reach for anyone, no matter how old or how young we all might be. It's not out of reach. And it's not 1,000 years from now. So what is this? Part of what I want to do is really the awareness of the language in searching, in search. When you search for a who am I, there can be a psychological component to that search. It can feel like you're the lost, surviving soul. Who am I? Who am I? And that you're trying to find yourself. And that may have a lot of spiritual or psychological credibility, because we do need to find and have some sense of our own identification in order to develop the stability to even ask these questions at a deeper and more profound meaning. But it's not where we stop. The who of the meditation really is looking not for a cementing of our position on earth, but a questioning, an opening of that dimension of who we have taken ourselves to be and who we might be or what we might be if we didn't take ourselves to be that particular definition. Now, the what, when we ask, what am I? Well, that can feel a little mechanical, can it? A little bit cold, a little bit distant. What am I? That seems a little drab to me. In fact, I read this. Some people send me poems, and I appreciate poems being sent. But here's one. This is by Louis Ferdinand Céline. Never heard of that person, but I like the bluntness of this. It says, "To hell with reality. I want to die in music, not in reason or in prose. People don't deserve the restraint we show by not going into to delirium in front of them. To hell with them." So don't you feel that sometimes? I mean, to hell with reality. I want the heart element in this thing, right? I want to know. I don't want to be. If it's mechanical and detached, I'd rather stay miserable. You ever feel that? Well, so the who becomes, when we feel that way, the who becomes our fallback position. And the what we are is a tough sell. It's not easily swallowed. But I hope as we go through this talk this evening that we warm ourselves to the what, and which is my intention in doing this. Because doesn't what necessarily imply dryness and mechanical and a mechanistic quality? Or does it just imply an impersonal quality? And do we equate mechanical trappings with the impersonal? Because that's a mistake. If we think our life only exists within the confines of our definition of who, then we miss the very source of life itself, which may be in the what. Stay very clear with my who's and what's tonight, because they can be profoundly confusing, even to the speaker. So sometimes it's not so much in arriving at the answer of whether we're a who or a what, but in the asking of whether we are a who or a what. That's a little harder perhaps to understand, because from the sense of self, we want a definition that we can move with. But it's that very definition that we move with that forms the who, no matter what we form it around. And maybe it's in not having the definition and just holding the question that the real answer points. The Buddha said, I love this quote, it's from the Anguttara Nikaya, "Yielding deliverance as their essence are all things. Merging with the deathless are all things. Terminating in nirvana are all things." I look around from the who, and it doesn't look like that at all to me, does it? It looks like very discrete and concrete things, and I don't see how they lead or transcend anywhere. They seem very reflective back, which they are, because when the mind codes something, regardless, then what we get back is what we're looking for. And it's through what we're looking that the reflection is derived. And so we confirm our own sense of identity by coding the world with our own mental processes. just reconfirming me and all the feelings I have about ourselves. This is absolutely the equation of life. We see the world exactly as we perceive ourselves in that moment. So don't blame it out there. So let's look at how the meditation practice begins to move us from the who that we start with in meditation to the what. Now, when we sit down, and I've used this before, but please stay with me, we begin to develop an objective ability. The mind has an objective ability. Awareness has an object to it. And when we invite awareness or attention to our inward process, we begin to see the what of our experience. You can't have a who in an object, can you? When you look at your mind and you see the emotions, the thoughts, the physical sensations, and all of the different displays of attitude and belief, when we really see them, when awareness sees something, that something is a what. It's not a who. Right? But when you are tied to what you see, when you have an opinion about what you see, when you have a reaction to what you see, then that tie-in, that attachment to it, makes it very strongly a who. It's a me, right? And so what was objective when we are just seeing clearly what it is becomes subjective when we are tied to it and in some kind of wanting or fearing way. My emotion, right? That's very different than seeing emotion. My thought. Because the tie-in there's something that we are continuing to need from the display of what the mind is doing, which we are strongly identified with and claim ownership of because of that neediness. So after a while, as we get quieter, how can we claim a who when there is only the what of what is seen? Even though we may, the next time we sit down, be full of a who. Stay with me on these words. They could be full of a who. But we all understand that what's happening there is that we are needing something, wanting something from this experience that we are unwilling to just let it be an experience. And so that's okay. We're not in any hurry. You can't push this thing. You can't push the who into a what. Understand that. There's no effort involved in this. This is a level of understanding. Who changes into a what when we are no longer needy or fearful of the experience at hand. And therefore, we have to understand our way out of who-ness, who-ville. And so, in another time, you might be sitting, and it's very clearly a dispassionate display. Dispassionate display. And then a memory comes up. And there's all sorts of fright and anxiety or stress, and then there's a who. And so this who-whatting is very much the extraction over time where we start with a who. The whoing and whatting actually continues for long, long periods of time. But it doesn't bother. At some point, you've hooed and what yourself to such a degree that it just isn't such of a problem. You realize where the problem lies. It lies in the investment we're giving, the outcome, the expectation, the hope, the fear. And we realize that we're not fully embracing the moment, because if we fully embrace the moment, the who immediately turns into a what. So there's an unsettledness there. Fine, no rush. Let me go to where the who feels unsettled. And what do we find in that unsettledness? But more whatness. So the second way our meditation brings us from who to what is in our reactivity, in the pains, the pain of events. This is very important. I hurt. You see the tie-in there? I hurt. And then when we get tied into the hurt, then the mind takes over with its projection, which is called thought. And it's a story that thought laces together. And then the hurt becomes a whole history of having been hurt and the fear of being hurt. And then the who, which is now far removed from the reality of now, has a full-blown history, because we haven't seen the what of our experience. The thought being a thought, the emotion being an emotion. The reaction, the fear behind the reaction. So we've missed something. It's all a blur. And when we're a who, what we're trying to do is get out of the glass maze. All we want to do is leave it. And the way we leave it is to add more of the same to the problem by trying to talk our way out. Trying to find and carve a position, a way that I can maneuver the problem, around the problem. But the problem is having not seen that the who was a what. Not adding to the who in terms of more story, more fuel on which the who moves. So we could begin to get onto this thing. Get onto this thing that pain in the story, pain in the story, pain, reactivity, pain and reactivity. That this isn't about improving the who. It's not about defining the who. It's not about changing the who. It's not about adding more to the who. It's not about improving the who. The who is the problem of having not seen what the who is. And so it's a question of understanding. It's a question of presence, not of ponderance. And the more the story takes over in its elaborative tale, the more remote the now becomes. The now is very distant. Because the who never sees the now. It never takes a stand in the now. And we see that the struggle to add more dimensionality to the who so that it can finally circumnavigate the problem is the problem. So the who is created from the what by giving the what a story. And so a process of mind, emotion as an emotion, a thought as a thought, can now claim selfhood, can now claim embodiment. can now claim a history. So we try to think ourselves out of that problem. You see, I just want to show the mechanism by which the who tries to solve the problem when it's not perceived correctly, further distances us from the solution. So thought becomes the mechanism by which the who inhabits the what. And it can't be fixed. It cannot be fixed. And we think because life is in transition, it's in transience, occasionally the problem alleviates itself, because all problems do if you just give it time. Things change. And then we claim, oh, it's working. But then it doesn't work for long because we're back in the same fix. And there can be persistent ways that we keep using thought to navigate ourselves to tranquility. Have you bumped your head enough? Have we bumped our head enough against the wall? So what does the who do when it realizes that it can't circumnavigate the problem, which is the first and second noble truth? It realizes that it has to go into the problem, because in the problem lies the definition of who. Who I think I am having this problem. And I worry about the problem implicating me, the who. So I don't want any part of the problem as a who, because it means that I'm an angry person or a selfish person or some other characteristic label that I want nothing to do with. So at some point, in order to put an end to the labeling of me, of mine, of who, I have to go into the problem with understanding, with non-reactivity. And from non-reactivity, I see that the problem never consisted of a person involved in it at all. That it was tension-filled reaction of greed or hatred or delusion that led to this tight-fisted need to control. And when I look at the problem, and I'm willing to look at the problem, which no who is, because it implicates me. It says something about me. But at some point, we have run out of options, and we have to go into it because we have no other options left, and we still hurt. And we can sit down, as I did as a six-year-old, and just be miserable. Or we can pick ourselves up at whatever age we are now and just say, okay, I don't care. Let's look at this thing. As soon as we're willing to face it, the problem starts dissolving because it's no longer outside of us. When the reaction was there, it was me having some pain, having a problem. But when I go into the problem itself without carrying me with it, then the problem cannot hold. Myself in its understanding. And so when we move into the problem, we question the words that have encased the problem, that have made the problem into something. So as we get quieter with ourselves, as we get more and more willing to go into the problem, we begin to see the solution to our life. doesn't mean that the conditioning doesn't keep taking us back into the who of life and the who. And it doesn't either mean that when we begin to observe, there isn't a subtle sense of who back there observing. But we have to be patient with that. Not try to get rid of it. Just be patient with it and quieter with it, and you'll begin to see that that will dissipate as well. Just have faith that that will. Just be patient with it, quiet and sincere. And start including the sense of the watcher as best as we can within that quietude. And we begin to see more and more that the mind is a process. Emotion is an emotion. And the who becomes almost cartoonish. It's like it's kind of funny when it arises and starts reacting. Sometimes I'm caught in a reaction, say at home, and there'd be this huge inward smile. It's just, but I can't seem to jump out of it. And it's having its own thing, so then you just kind of let it burn out of fuel and say, wow, that's amazing. And I think that kind of humor that simultaneously with the reaction is sort of the last roar of a dying lion. So we begin to see that the what of how this body mind is formed is a quieter position than the who, than relating to it as a who. But it's not like a sudden movement from who to what. We often carry some sense of resistance into the process of meditation long after we understand the difference between the who and the what. And we're tired of so many thoughts, and we're irritated that we are so governed by those thoughts, and we find all of ourselves keep coming out and rebuilding the who because our mental processes don't feel completely safe yet. And when they're not safe, there's going to be a who that is trying to make them safe, which is why we spend so much time inside. When the who genuinely becomes a what, there's no need to go in. Because the truth does not lie internally or externally. It doesn't lie in losing my projections in the world, nor does it lose in staying internal with my... Because we're like a cat at a mouse hole, so we can catch ourselves at the moment we become a who, which is because we don't feel like the who is safe. And unless I'm a what, I can't relax. And then when I am a what, I might who myself. I'm not sure we should go on the web, this talk. It's a little bit... So the presence of the watcher means that there's still something needed or feared within the experience of myself. It doesn't feel, it's not safe yet. Awakening doesn't constantly have this inward vigilance that we do. Although that inward vigilance is very important until we come to the sense of inward safety. We don't trust ourselves. We still don't trust our emotions to be just what they are. So we haven't what the process enough. It's just what it means nothing. It goes nowhere. We don't have to keep track of it like a bloodhound on a escaped criminal. We can relax with our inward life because it goes nothing. It means nothing. Do you realize that your emotions mean nothing? Are you ready to go there? not to reality. They don't mean a thing. But then you see, to call ourselves a what? What about the pain of compassion? What about those moments of being deeply affected by life? That doesn't feel like the what of a mechanical what to me. So to take up residence by definition into a what misses something very vital, alive, very awake, very caring. So I can't call myself a what. So both the who and the what we have to throw out. Neither one hold the complete understanding. You see, when you begin to realize that it can't be mechanical, and yet there's a mechanical component to the conditioning, but why is it that life should have a subjective experience at all? Why wouldn't it just be all black inside if it were mechanical? We begin to realize that awareness, is not something we bring to something, but it's the very composition of everything. That awareness is an intrinsic part, an inherent part of reality. And that awareness holds no definition or name. And that our attempt to name ourselves within awareness is to miss the point. We're not trying to be a who, and although being a what may be a skillful means to escape the self-trauma of who-ness, it's not the ending point. That in fact, awareness holds no name. There's no name. And therefore it holds no distinction, because only name gives distinction. And therefore the who and the what come together. And in the seeing is neither personal nor impersonal. And when it comes up as personal, then it comes up as impersonal. Those are just perspectives on the truth of awareness, that neither one holds the truth of awareness. It's like light, and I am a very amateur physicist, very amateur, but light, when one display of experiment will prove itself to be a wave, and another experiment, irrefutable, it proves itself to be a particle. So the photon, which is the composite of light, is both a wave and a particle. The mind cannot embrace both of those things simultaneously. And yet light is both of those things simultaneously. In exactly the same way, you and I are both a who and a what, simultaneously. And that's the absolute truth. That's the truth that cannot be denied. Make a distinction, and you have pitted one against the other. You have the particle, and the mind just can't, if it's a particle, it cannot be a wave. And if it's a wave, it cannot be, the mind cannot solve that mental equation. But stillness can. when you don't make distinctions, you're the perfect who and what, and therefore the perfect light being in that moment. If you want to call it anything, call it now. Because the now holds it all. And asks for no distinction whatsoever. All things are awareness. It is when we mind awareness, M-I-N-D, using it as a verb, when we mind awareness, that we have all the distinction, all the problems, and all the path out of the problem. When really the path out of the problem is to see life as it is, without distinction. Not needing to look inside, not needing to look outside. Not needing to affirm me or deny me. Not needing to redefine me as a what. Just seeing. Just seeing. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? You see, as you sit, if you let the mind engage discursively in what was said, we're really missing the whole point of what was said. The mind can't reason itself out of itself. And that's why when you ask a question, holding the question is far closer to the truth than the resolution of the question. But how many of us feel safe enough in just holding a question? Because we're not very defined when we do so. When we have an answer, then the sense of me has something to hold as its own and invite and invest its security within. But in a question, there's just awareness. Who are you? What are you? And you begin to see whether we're living inside of the glass maze, or whether we're willing to step out of it. Because the exit is as close to us as stillness. As close to us as awareness. Not a configured awareness. Not me using awareness. Because everything is composed of it. It can't be used. It can only be relaxed into. We relax the who out of existence. And then we don't invite a redefinition of whatness. And then we know our true place in things, which is no place at all. So if you have any questions or comments tonight, I'd be happy to try to who or what my way out of it. Yes. You have to speak up, Kevin.
Oh, sometimes something of a puppet can be irritating.
Yes. Yes.
Uncomfortable. Or
yes.
And now I see myself being unwilling to face it, so I'll face it. And it's really interesting how, and that thing I was so unwilling to face, sort of, there's nothing there.
Right.
And so, I'm sure I can describe how. So that's sort of like the who, I guess, feels like evaporating from, and then I'm left with
yes.
whether the situation like the sounds or the
right.
feeling
my yes.
feet or my muscles.
Yes. Try to make this as concise because I have to repeat
yeah, okay.
it. Yeah.
Anyway, so what eventually gets real transparent is sort of like, you know, when the who
yes.
leaves the space.
Yes.
The what gets all like frozen smoke and gets
yes.
through that and then just
fade. Yes. So if I'm hearing you right, there's from time to time you'll have a problem or a difficulty, and instead of running from it, you'll turn to it. And as you relax into it, which is the crucial element, the sense of it being problematic and the who changes, opens up, there's a hole in the who. It's not as firm, it's not as defined. And yet, when you go into the what, there can be some residue of the who watching the what. And that sense of, oh, you know, first of all, it might be, is this safe being a what? I was safe being a who, but is it safe being a what? There might be a little confusion about being, not being who you thought you were and being different than what you believed yourself to be. There can be not a complete relaxation within the whatness is what I'm saying. When there isn't a complete relaxation in the whatness, then the who is going to be behind there watching the whatness. And because the definition of how a who builds upon itself is in reactivity, is in non-complete rest. And so even if there's not rest, even though you've dissipated a lot of the problem and have understood very deeply, the who doesn't give up and just say, well, you've passed that dimension, now you're on your own. It starts fighting back at more and more subtle in more and more subtle ways. So your job is to see all of that and relax even more so that you're never offering a residual argument to the one that's being sustained. So that you're willing to feel what it is that's going on and add nothing to it. But there is complete awareness of it because in truth, when the who opens to a what, and the what to then opens to awareness itself is not configured. It's not defined, although there may be the subtle sense of definition that maintains itself just from having a history with something. It's not limited to that definition any longer. And much greater space that surrounds it is a not knowing. Which is the hardest thing for the who to put up with, because it sees its own demise within the not knowing. And the way it holds off its own demise, which it fears will be catastrophic, is to invite argument within that dissolution. so they can come back into form, so they can take a place in things. So just for all you have to do, the only thing, the only requirement is non-resistance. 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 If we offer non-resistance to whatever the mind presents, the mind needs resistance to sustain itself. So if it doesn't have resistance to sustain itself, it opens. It opens beyond itself. When it opens beyond itself, it never closes back completely again. Seen once is seen for a lifetime. But as we get close, it gets more fearful, or can get more fearful. That's not the case for everyone. And it can feel more terrorizing. And we then, what terror is resistance to the unknown. It is configuring what the unknown is going to become, which as if we knew what the unknown was going to become. But fear claims that it does through thought. And therefore we lose the ground of now into the fear of thought. And then we become a who again. Does that make sense to you? Right. So what you begin to learn is all how the mind works. You learn its strategies as if you were doing it yourself, which you are. And they become very apparent. That's why it always feels like you're coming back home when the Dharma is, because you're doing it to yourself and you recognize what you're doing to yourself when it's brought up in Dharma language. There's the recognition of that. If something were doing it to you, how would you ever have any recognition factor? And so it's really just knowing yourself completely, and that's it. Yes. Yes. Yes, I would be happy to. He says, in the bouncing back and forth between the who and the what role does compassion play? Compassion is the way we look. The looking itself is a very nice question. The looking itself is the willingness. It's just the looking itself. Open-hearted looking. Unfooled, sincere, open-hearted looking. It's like I went to the zoo and I got, you know, I went to the zoo and I saw a monkey. I went to the zoo and I saw a monkey and a rat. Open-hearted, sincere, caring, non-involved, non-personalized. It's all of those things. It's the awareness itself. You feel it. You feel your pain that you're causing yourself. When you see the pain you're causing yourself, compassion responds by wanting to understand that pain. The mechanism by which compassion works is not violence, but understanding. So when it feels the pain of being a who, or moving from a what to a who, it brings understanding. It wants to invite understanding into what seems to be problematic there. And so it invites awareness into it, because that's the mechanism for understanding. And when an awareness sees what it is that's going on, then, and it sees its role in what's going on, and I have to use duality here to explain, then it surrenders the who needing to do anything about the what. And that's a mystery on how that happens, because it's not the who that surrenders that control. It's the seeing that lets that mechanism surrender, to let go. Let go, in genuine, sincere, doesn't come from the person who's letting go. It comes from the seeing, from the understanding. Awareness inviting itself to itself is letting go. Yes, in the back.
Last week when we were doing the diets, I found seemed to kind of lighten up and to loosen, and there was much more of the what.
Good.
Was there.
Yes.
And there wasn't nearly as much of a need to respond.
Right.
And in a way, you know, going into it, I felt the opposite. Like, that would be much harder.
Yes.
To rest with that.
Yes.
With the silence of it.
Yes. No, he said that last week when we did the dyads, in the beginning there was a lot of who involved in the dyad and a lot of perhaps anxiety about responding correctly and all of that, which forms the who. That's why the who is there. It's formed around that fear. And that once the process unfolded, the what of the experience became more obvious. Because there was less anxiety, more sense of safety within oneself and within one, listen carefully, your projection of what that other person would want from you. Or what you think to be a good meditator you should have said or would say. All of those different psychological resistances create the who. And what the problem with just psychological responses is that they take you to a healthier who. But they don't really penetrate that. They don't make the who transparent. And the transparency of the who and stillness and quiet as you became more quiet in that dia, you had less to say, which is exactly the way it can go when you are extracting the who from the process. And you saw it there. You saw it. But the level of psychology is so strong in us because, and only because, the level of pain within that dimension is so strong within us. We have so many feelings about ourselves, so much tightness, so much self-unacceptance, that the projections come at us with such turmoil and such vigor that we can get caught up in that whoing ourselves in that dimension for eons, really. The problem is never what it takes to transcend a dimension. It's whether we're willing to do it or not. That's all it is. To be willing to do it, we have to go into the difficulty. Not play from the difficulty. Oh, I wonder what she's thinking of me. I better answer her. That's playing from the difficulty. Going into the difficulty is feeling the pain of the inadequacy that is inviting that reaction. When we go into the pain of what we're feeling about ourselves, then the who can open up to a what. It can't open up as long as we're trying to correct the response, because that way we're trying to solve the problem. And the problem is the embodiment of resistance to being what you are. Does that make sense? Yes.
How is committing to a relationship helpful in that process?
How is committing to a relationship helpful in that process? Well, it depends on what you mean by relationship. If you mean a romantic relationship or a therapeutic relationship or any friendship or whatever. And it also depends on what you mean by commitment. One of the differentiations I make is the difference between being committed, which is just being in presence and body, just having your body show up and being in place and time with another person. That's what it means for most of us to be committed. I'm going to be here until I die. But that's very different than showing up. When we have a relationship in which we show up from and which we want to work with the projection of how I become within it, then it's possible to enter a listening, which is as firm of a practice as any meditation we've ever done sitting by ourselves, because it requires the same thing from it. and you see the projection that is occurring as you sit with somebody. And when you see that, because obviously the person doesn't hold what the mind is doing to it, you have the ability, if you feel safe with that person, and that's a big, to be able to see the projection as it's occurring. And when we're no longer responding to that projection as it's occurring, you can then have total attention between the two people. And there's no who on either end of that. And it's often a very timeless moment of attention meeting itself. Very powerful. Very, very powerful. But then we come out of it and say, oh, I was really absorbed in that conversation. I lost myself for a while. We claim ownership, again, never realizing what really occurred in there was the absence of the very sense of ownership. You see? We never give ourselves the advantage of our own truth. Because we don't or can't conceive of ourselves as being anything but a who. Yes.
It's hard for me to understand how I can see and understand without using my mind.
It is hard to understand how you can see and understand without your mind. It's very difficult, especially when we've used our minds in one form of understanding, intellectual understanding, our whole life. We just have to keep... this is where faith comes in, really. I say this to you. It is possible, and it is true, that clarity far outreaches the depth of anything the mind could possibly understand. And that a mind that is not infiltrated with thinking or absorbed in its own thought or self-absorbed is a mind that can transcend individuality and see it as I am seeing you. That's what's known as insight. That's also in a sustained way known as awakening. So we have to stop for this evening.